Hi there, welcome to House to Astonish, episode 65. I'm Al Kennedy.
And I'm Paul O'Brien, and as the United States wrangles with how to address its debt problems, we ask, is it time to open the strategic vibranium reserves for drilling?
Later on, we're going to be reviewing Amazing Spider-Man, Daredevil, and Our Love is Real, but first we're looking a bit at the news that come out of San Diego.
Normally we do these solicitations in a week like this as well, but to be honest, all of the important stuff was already announced at San Diego anyway, so we'll just work it into the news.
Mm-hmm. DC, as you would imagine, have not got a whole heck of a lot of stuff launching in October, given that they've got their entire line launching in September.
There's a few minis, but at the end of the day, let's just focus on the news.
One thing we should point out from the solicitations, particularly from DC's solicitations, is the omnibus that they're bringing out of the new 52 in October.
Yes.
Where when all the second issues come out, they've got this handy-dandy sampler of all 52. When I say sampler, it's a 1,200-page hardback for $125 containing all 52 first issues. Is it me, or is that the least satisfying reading experience you will ever have?
Unless they're all going to be single-issue stories, which would very much surprise me. Mm. That seems to me like a very odd product. I can't imagine who would want to own all 52 first issues who wouldn't want to own the actual physical first issues.
Yeah.
I don't really get it. I suppose there could be the odd collector who's not planning to, who wants to get the first issue of series they don't like, but I just don't really understand it.
Well, it's like when Marvel did that trade paperback for the Heroic Age that was the first issues of the Avengers books, plus I think Hawkeye and Mockingbird and possibly Jeff Parker's reboot of Thunderbolts. That was, I thought, a fairly silly idea. Because it's just the first issues, it's not the story. And DC have managed to trump that by producing a book that is too big to hold, too heavy to sit on your knee, far too expensive, and none of the stories conclude in it.
If you're looking for a very, very expensive brick, possibly something that you can use to fend off muggers, even then, I think you can probably do better with a sledgehammer or something along those lines.
If you want an occasional table for your living room, something you could put your cups of coffee and your chips and dips down on.
A really odd product. Let's talk about some stuff that was announced at San Diego and generally announced.
Brian K. Vaughan is making his return to Monthly Comics, which is good. I mean, it's only been a year, actually, since Ex Machina finished up.
That's quite a long time, though, in somebody's career.
Yeah, we kind of thought that he was going to be going away forever. It did seem that was, just from what he was saying in interviews and so on, that he seemed more interested in moving into doing TV and movies than he was in staying in comics. But he and Fiona Staples are going to be doing an ongoing series at Image, which is going to be called Saga, which is a science fiction family drama set against the backdrop of a war. To be honest, this sounds pretty promising to me. I mean, I wonder whether we'll get the same thing that seemed to happen in some of Vaughan's other comics, which is once an issue you would get a fact dump. Ex Machina was particularly bad for it, where dialogue would stop for a minute while he did the tiny civics lesson.
Yes. Did you know that in 1973, a local election in New York? there is a little bit of that in Brian Vaughan's writing. I would guess that maybe just after a few months away from comics, his taste for it has maybe come back to him. He's got one of these writers who's got enough of a reputation now that he can get away with announcing a series which, to be honest, if it came from somebody you'd never heard of, you'd just say, okay, that sounds like a generic 70s space opera. Mm-hmm. But then the 70s space opera is actually kind of a moribund genre. And Vaughan's an interesting enough writer that you just know he's not going to do a bog-standard, off-the-peg genre story. So presumably he's going to do something interesting within that. And I'm guessing that we'll see something in the first couple of issues that explains why this is more than just another story that that could have been done in any sort of 60s, 70s magazine.
I think he seems to be going for the kind of sweeping family drama kind of thing. I think that's why it's called Saga, really, is it's supposed to be a kind of a big scale style of thing rather than just... I think the emphasis is on the family drama rather than on the war aspect of it. That's what it plays out in the background of, in the same way that, Gone with the Wind is not really about the war that frames its backdrop. It's about the characters.
Absolutely.
I suspect this will be the same thing for Saga.
But there's nothing wrong with the space opera setting as a backdrop any more than... It's just a variant of the fantasy setting, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you do with it. And he's being very quiet about what he's doing with it, other than to tell us essentially what genre he's working in. But yeah, that's fine. It's Brian Vaughan. I'll give it a shot.
Yeah, I can't think of anything that he's done that I've thought was a bad comic. Ex Machina had, to be honest, I thought a bit of a poor ending. Like, that last issue was not a great last issue. But everything up to that I thought was great. And Runaways is one of my favourite comics that has come out of Marvel in the past 10 years. I mean, I think it's a staggeringly good bit of work. Some of his other stuff I've not read. I've not read all the way to the end of Why the Last Man. I got four or five books into that, and my interest in it kind of petered out a little. People say it's good, but
it's got a great last issue.
Fair enough. Well, it turns out he can write a good last issue there in that case. Also out of San Diego, DC have announced a new ongoing series to accompany Fables. Now that Jack of Fables is wrapped up, there's going to be a new companion title. I think because they realised that Fables is now their cash cow. It's their main title. I mean, Hellblazer will roll on until the world ends, but Fables is the one that makes the sales.
Jack of Fables ended in a really, really odd way. I don't know,
I've never read Jack of Fables. I am reading Fables, but slowly and when I've got time in trade paperback, so I'm only up to the third trade of Fables.
Yeah, Jack of Fables, it sort of builds to this big climax, and then kind of stops unexpectedly. It's deliberately playing with readers' expectations, but it is one of the things you sort of read the final issue and you think, yes, you have successfully swerved my expectations. I'm not sure you've done it in a very satisfying or interesting way, but you have successfully swerved my expectations. I've stopped reading Fables, actually. I think it hits a point where it very obviously reaches a natural ending and then just keeps going.
Right.
And I think it's much like Shade the Changing Man would probably have been best served if it had called it a day at issue 50.
Yeah.
I get the same sort of feeling about Fables these
days.
Issue
75.
It's not that it's become a bad book. It's just you get the feeling it keeps going out of a sense of inertia rather than because it's got some great story it still needs to tell. And now, in fairness, this new series sounds as though it's replacing the series of minis they've been doing with Cinderella anyway. So it's not really a new book so much as a rebranding of the existing third title.
Yeah, it's going to be called Fairest, and it's going to be focused on the women of Fabletown. The first arc is going to be a Sleeping Beauty arc by Bill Willingham with art by Phil Jimenez.
That should be good.
And then the third arc, I think, is going to be another one of Chris Roberson and Sean McManus's Cinderella stories. So
I wasn't wild about those.
And they're bringing in other people, they're bringing in novelists and so on to work on it too.
I mean, I seem to be in the minority, but I didn't really like those Cinderella minis. The idea was supposed to be that Cinderella was a James Bond type spy. Mm. And it never really felt to me like those two ideas went together. It's sort of, that's a neat idea on paper, but somehow it just ends up as genre elements from two different stories sort of whizzing past one another without ever meeting. Mm-hmm. That's how I felt about it.
Roman Dirge has announced that his comic book Lenora is going to be turned into a movie. He'd like to go down the route of a CGI animated movie with it, and that Neil Gaiman is going to be acting as executive producer for it.
That's a good name to have attached.
Definitely, well, particularly to something like Lenore, which is, it's funny and it's quite bleak, but it's also very kind of gothy. And if you're going to have something that is like that, then someone like Neil Gaiman is a good name to have on board because he's got a lot of cachet behind him in that kind of an area. Goths love Neil Gaiman.
Do we know who's producing this?
Who's actually going to be making the movie? Yeah. No, at the moment it literally is just Roman Dirge has written a script. Neil Gaiman wants to executive produce it. They're looking for a director at the minute, and then once they've got that, they'll shop it around studios.
Oh, okay, so when you say it's becoming an animated movie, what you mean is that Roman
Dirge
and Neil Gaiman
for it to become an animated
are
movie.
Going to pitch it. But to be fair, if Neil Gaiman's pitching it and it's not astronomically expensive, I would think that somebody is likely to be interested.
Yeah, well, I guess, but I mean, look how long it's taken them. They haven't been able to get that Death movie made that Gaiman wrote yonks ago and wants to direct himself. And,
true.
You know, nobody's managed to get that made yet. Sticking with media adaptations, The Sixth Gun, Oni Press's series of supernatural westerns, is becoming a miniseries on Sci-Fi Channel, or Sci-Fi, as I believe it's just called now. I don't think it's pronounced like that, but it amuses me to do
Sci-Fi, S-Y-F-Y, because they wanted to move away from branding themselves as being a sci-fi channel.
Yeah, so call yourself sci-fi, but don't spell it right.
Well, to be fair, there's a lot of stuff on that network now that has nothing at all to do with sci-fi. Smackdown being a particularly good example.
So maybe it's not pronounced sci-fi. Maybe it's like sci-fi. It's a bit sci-fi, it's sci-fi.
Yeah, but ECW was the first wrestling show that was put on sci-fi, and that caused absolute fury among the sci-fi hardcore.
They had that vampire that hung around in the car park because he wasn't allowed to enter the building.
Yes, they literally did that. This was apparently the writers having been told, you must include something to keep sci-fi happy. There must be some sort of fantasy element in this. And apparently there were serious discussions about doing something like having a wrestler make his entrance from a UFO lowered from the ceiling or something like that. And what they ended up with was the ECW zombie, who simply was a zombie that shuffled his way to the ring and was then beaten to death with a stick. And that was it.
Kill it.
It was awesome. He did a promo before the match, which, as I recall, consisted of him grabbing the mic and going, and that was their concession to being on the sci-fi network. So yeah, Sixth Gun is obviously not a sci-fi concept. It is a fantasy genre concept. Mm-hmm. It's actually something that sounds like it would lend itself quite well to a TV miniseries.
Yeah, what they're doing with it apparently is that they're going to adapt the first six issues as this six-part miniseries. And if it goes down well, then they're going to make an ongoing TV show out of it.
They're going to do a whole 1 hour episode for each issue.
I don't know if they're going to do exactly one issue equals one episode, but I mean, there's plenty that goes on in that first six issue story. You could fill six episodes of a miniseries fairly easily.
That's true. You could flesh it out. You could add in a few subplots. You could give a bit more detail to things. It's just, you know, normally you could get through six issues of any comic in a lot less than 6 hours of television time.
Yeah.
Well, of course, American television, 4.5 hours of television time, whatever
chase,
it is.
You know, a chase across the prairies on horseback could take 2 pages in a comic. It could take 10 minutes on screen. You know, it could be anything. Marvel had a bunch of announcements which they made at San Diego. They actually had quite a lot of initiatives announced, which...
This is unusual.
Really didn't do.
This is unusual because the last few years, publishers have tended to steer clear of announcing things at San Diego.
I think they're seeing what people are reporting is that movie studios have realised that just because you go big at Comic-Con doesn't guarantee your movie will do well. Green Lantern did not do well. Scott Pilgrim did not do well. Serenity did not do well. All these movies, big, big hits at Comic-Con. Snakes on a Plane, for goodness sake, big, big hit at Comic-Con and made its money, but it didn't. It wasn't the hit that they were expecting it to be.
Well, Green Lantern is a bad example because that got bad reviews overall anyway. And when it got excitement at Comic-Con, that was on the basis of a few trailers before people had actually seen what the film itself was like. But yeah, something like Scott Pilgrim or Serenity, those are classic examples of things that have a core audience that's overwhelmingly present at Comic-Con, and it just doesn't follow that there's a wider appeal beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, much as we would like to think, oh, well, if people got to see these things, then surely they would love them. Not necessarily. People don't always just follow on with what, you know, the internet or what Twitter thinks. I mean, if you were to go by the internet's reaction to Snakes on a Plane before it came out, Snakes on a Plane was going to gross more than Titanic. And Snakes on a Plane came out. Everyone who wanted to see it saw it, I presume, midnight on the first day that it came out. Certainly, I went to a midnight showing of it because I thought it would be quite entertaining. It was entertaining enough. I guess it wasn't the fun movie that I thought it was going to be. I was expecting something more like Tremors, and I got something more like Final Destination 2.
But hold on a second. When they commissioned Snakes on a Plane, they probably were expecting it to be about as successful as it actually was. It only underperformed relative to the hype generated by the internet.
Yep.
It did perfectly well relative to the amount they spent on it and what they could possibly have hoped for when somebody signed off on a film called Snakes on a Plane.
Exactly, but then when it was built up to, you know, the projections that they would have had for how much it was going to make, and then the amount that they spent on promoting it on the back of that, particularly online.
That's true. They wasted a lot of money on advertising, which didn't do them any good.
No.
Because it had so much hype already.
And this is what apparently studios are seeing from Comic-Con is, yeah, we get a good feedback from Comic-Con and we can kind of tell what things are going to go down well with a nerdy audience. But that doesn't translate to the general public liking it as well. So
it may not.
Movie studios are scaling a little back. They're not going away or anything like that, but they're not going a psycho. They didn't go a psycho this year as they did last year and the year before.
Yeah, some superhero, sci-fi, fantasy, whatever films have a broader appeal. Some don't. Mm. Duh.
Yeah, the Twilight panel won't be there next year, I would imagine, given that there'll be no Twilight film next year. The last one's coming out this year, so...
Yep.
I'm guessing that there won't be the lines around the block of 13-year-old girls and their 45-year-old mothers.
Not further Twilight books to be adapted?
No, four.
Oh, okay.
Although, are they doing the last... I think they might be doing the last book as two films because they've seen that it worked for Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Well, maybe there will be another blooming Twilight panel next year. Well, fair dues to them, frankly. I mean, if that's what they enjoy, I think it's rubbish. Doesn't matter what I think. I don't have to read them. You know, I think, given that I read some right old rubbish comics by anyone else's standards, which give me great enjoyment, I don't think I can really judge anybody else for what they like.
There's nothing fundamentally wrong with Twilight for what it is and the audience it's targeted at.
Yeah. Marvel actually did have some announcements to make this year, though. They announced two new ongoing series and a whole bunch of other projects.
Well, one of those isn't really a new ongoing series. It's Incredible Hulk, which is replacing Incredible Hulks. So that's just a
relaunch. The downscaling by one letter.
They're getting rid of one Hulk. Times are tough. And all of the Hulks had to apply for their jobs again. And all the Hulks put an application, and one of them just wasn't as good at being a Hulk as the other Hulks.
Yeah, and we're all going to have to adapt. You know, we can't be a two-Hulk family anymore. I'm sorry, if one of us needs the Hulk one day, then we'll just have to take it, and the other person might not be able to get around as easily.
It's a bad time to be a Hulk. They're being told they're having to contribute more to their pensions.
It's being outsourced. There are foreign Hulks now that are just... they can do the hulking and the smashing much, much more cheaply, and they don't complain about it.
It's true. So, yeah, Incredible Hulk is being brought back, and Mark Silvestri is drawing it, isn't it?
Yeah, and Jason Aaron writing.
I mean, I can't believe Silvestri's going to be doing more than the first few issues, because I think it's been a while since he's done an extended run on anything.
He did 6 issues of Deadly Genesis, didn't he?
That is true, but I don't regard that as an extended run. I'm sure he'll do the first arc, but, I mean, he still owns Top Cow.
Yeah.
I would assume that's still going to take up most of his time in the long run. He's done the odd arc for Marvel before, and no doubt he'll do an arc here, and there'll be a lot of contribution from the guys at the studio.
I would be surprised to see him alternate arcs, actually, with somebody else. Like, he'll do 6, and then someone else will do 6, and he'll come back and do 6. He does still seem to be, unlike people like Todd McFarlane, or I know he's theoretically doing Justice League, but, you know, we'll see how long he does that for. Jim Lee is the other example. They don't draw a lot of comics. Mark Silvestri seems to be a guy who actually does enjoy drawing comics, and... you know.
I'm sure he does, but my point is that he's got his own company through which he can draw comics. He doesn't need to do it for Marvel. And
if he wants to draw the Hulk, he pretty much needs to do it for Marvel.
The fact that you don't own a character has never stopped anybody from creating a knockoff and drawing it anyway.
Yeah, particularly not Top Cow.
Now, I'd be very surprised if he would, at the same time as he was running his own company within Image, he was going to become a long-term regular penciler on a book for Marvel. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure he'll do this arc, because he's completed arcs for Marvel before. And Defenders, that's the other one. Defenders is being brought back. There's a trademark to be renewed.
I'm quite pleased about this. I know that you're very down on Fraction's recent Marvel work. I think that, you know, the problem has been that his Thor, right, you've had basically, he's done 3 mini arcs on Thor. He's done the first arc, which was a set of one-shots in the Secret Invasion miniseries.
And that was good.
Wait a second, did Gillen write the Secret Invasion miniseries?
I think Kevin Gillen may have written it. But Faction certainly wrote a load of one-shots for Thor, which were very good.
Yes, the Agents of Thunder stuff.
I was looking forward to his run on Thor when it started, and then I read it, and I wasn't looking forward to much anymore.
His first arc is not that great. His second, the one that's running in Mighty Thor at the moment, is actually fine.
I dropped it with the relaunch. I was so irritated by the quality and incoherence of that arc that I just thought, I'm not spending more money on this.
See, I think it wasn't even the whole arc, it was just the last couple of issues, which were very kind of slapdash.
They were a mess. They were an absolute mess.
But the first couple of issues were actually, I thought, were fine. But it's not what you want to see as a whole story.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he has also had that run on Uncanny X-Men where he never really clicked.
That's polite.
It's not the worst run on Uncanny X-Men we've seen in recent years.
It
doesn't reach Casey or Austin levels of bad.
It doesn't reach Austin. I would say it's about on a par with Casey. There's glimmers of decent ideas, but it just doesn't work. It never gets going. You sort of will it to do well for 6 to 8 months, and then after a while you just think, I've got to accept this isn't very good. And I'm afraid, it's been a while since I've read anything from Matt Fraction that I thought was especially decent. And I'd come round to the view that part of his problem is that he's not good at juggling large casts, which certainly seems to be one of the problems with Uncanny X-Men, and might explain why some of his best-received work at Marvel has been on Iron Fist.
And Iron Man.
And Iron Man. And, for that matter, the reprints of Casanova. Mm. But you did point out to me, in fairness, that he also wrote Order, which was a very good team book.
I really liked the Order. I mean, a lot of people didn't, which I think is strange. I mean, they were all new cast, etc., but I think it was some of the best new characters that Marvel had introduced for a while. And they've got a lot of potential. It's a bit of a shame that no one's really used them. So he can write a team book. And similarly, you know, we say he's better off at writing solo characters. It's the Bendis syndrome. We look at that first arc of his Thor run, and it's not very good. But, you know, his one-shots that were before it that form a loose story are very good. And his current arc on Mighty Thor, I think, is a step up from his first. It's not at the level of that first set of one-shots, which were superb. But, you know, it's better than it was.
Given the general quality of the stuff I've read with Matt Fraction's name on it in the last year, I'm afraid I have great difficulty getting particularly excited about any new project he's launching now.
Well, I see, I'm still enough of a fan of his work so to give him a chance on Defenders.
I'd like to hope that
Iron Man, I think, is still consistently good. His Iron Fist was the best, literally the best work that's ever been done with the character, I think.
Possibly. I haven't read enough other Iron Fist stories to really have a view on that.
Well, the first lot were Claremont and Byrne, and they're better than those Claremont and Byrne stories.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
He hasn't had much of a solo ongoing life apart from that sort of first 15, 20 issues or whatever it was.
I would like to hope that Fraction will get back to doing work of the quality of things like Iron Fist or Order, or basically the quality of stuff he was doing before he started on Uncanny. Mm-hmm. But, you know, until he does start producing that sort of work again, I can't honestly say that I have great hopes. I could be wrong. Like, he could turn around and recapture what people were seeing in him a year or so back, but he's kind of... I've lost faith in him, I'm afraid.
I think people have also been put off by Fear Itself, and I can't blame them really for that. Fear Itself has had some... Well, mixed reviews is putting it nicely. Issue 4, where we finally get some hints as to what's actually happening. You know, we should probably have been getting this in issue 1, or at the latest, the beginning of issue 2.
There's some fascinating structural issues with that series as well, just in terms of failing to set up moments that are meant to be dramatic. Mm-hmm. Which is very odd in a... in an experienced writer, and I don't know what's going on there. Mm-hmm. I think there's maybe something that occasionally afflicts writers and editors at Marvel, which is they spend so long talking about a story and know it so well that they kind of just assume or forget that the background needs to be laid out for the reader. Mm-hmm. As well. It flies past everyone that the groundwork hasn't been done to make these moments dramatic the way they are in their own minds.
Yeah. Marvel have been, just to go slightly off of this topic, but yeah, the Defenders, Fraction and Dodson, I'm looking forward to seeing what it's like. But Marvel are also doing one of these cover stripping things again.
Oh, yes.
For Flashpoint tie-ins, where they're saying, oh, well, we just want to help out our retail partners. It's like, well, how's about... You ask them how many copies of Fearsome 4 they've got sitting on their shelves and ask them to send back those instead.
To be fair, I doubt how many people actually ordered Fearsome 4.
Well, quite. It's like, well, you know, you think that, oh, they're not selling through these Flashpoint miniseries. At least they ordered the Flashpoint miniseries.
I don't know. What is the anecdotal report on sell-through on those Flashpoint minis? Because they were ordered fairly high. We still haven't seen ICV2's estimates of the June sales, which mm-hmm. is... I assume they've been distracted by San Diego or something. But certainly in terms of the chart placements, those Flashpoint minis were actually ordered quite respectably. Mm-hmm. Flashpoint itself may be tailing in behind Fear Itself, but the tie-ins have done surprisingly well.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I guess it will probably depend on who the creative teams are or something, because they're wildly variable in terms of the profiles of the people who are working on them. You know, it goes all the way from... some of their biggest name writers, you got James Robinson's and people like that are working with some of them, Brian Azzarello, people like that, and all the way down to guys that they stole off the writing staff at Supernatural and former assistant editors at Vertigo.
Yeah. Battle scars, shattered heroes, and the fearless. This is all Fallout or post-Fear Itself stuff. Mm. This is similar to what we've seen before.
Yeah, battle scars is the banner.
It's the equivalent of the Heroic Age of Initiative banners.
Or Dark Reign, things like that. Shattered Heroes is going to be a set of, I think it's 3 or 4 one-shots, just looking at like Captain America and Iron Man and Thor and people like that, and their fallout from the Fear Itself thing. The Fearless is a 12-issue fortnightly miniseries.
With loads of different creators. So
yeah,
presumably
good creators as well.
So presumably Chris it's Yost an anthology.
Chris Yost and Cullen Bunn and Matt Fraction and Paul Pelletier and Mark Bagley.
And it's something to do with what happens to the Hammers after Fear Itself.
It's a tour of the Marvel Universe, essentially, showing the sort of post-Fear Itself landscape.
Okay.
To be honest, the concept doesn't thrill me that much, but it's a good set of creators, I think.
Again, in fairness to Marvel, they usually aren't able to go into much detail about these post-crossover stories until they've finished most of the plot of the crossover itself. So I'll wait and see what they say is happening next. A lot of the time, the stuff that follows the crossover can be interesting, even if the story that gets you there isn't.
Mm-hmm. Marvel also announced that they're going day and date with the Spider-Man and the X-Men books with a view to eventually going day and date with the whole line.
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously following in DC's footsteps here, but I mean, the suggestion seems to be that they're taking these as suitable books to go day and date with now, and they're looking for obvious jumping on points where they can start running other books digitally, which I can understand. You don't want to have the runs available on the digital app starting, you know, in part 4 of a 7-part story or something like that. Mm-hmm. It makes sense for it to start with a suitable jumping on point. I do think that Marvel and DC, if they're going to switch to an overall day and date approach, do need to have a look at the layout of those apps and make sure that it's a lot easier to find the jumping on point for new series, because it's so hard to filter out what's genuinely a new comic from what's simply an old thing from 1978 that happens to have been put on the system lately.
Yeah, well, if you say, for instance, you know, this is Incredible Hulk brackets 1965 brackets 172. It's like,
that is an incredibly unhelpful way of identifying which series is which. They identify it by the year, not when that issue came out, but with the year when issue 1 of that series came out. And if you're going to use years rather than volume numbers, which I can understand, do it the way the official handbook and the Marvel Index do, which is to use the year that the issue came out when it's then somewhat informative.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are lots of problems with the way that Marvel and DC are doing their apps at the moment. Marvel in particular. I mean, DC have dipped their toes into selling collections. The Planetary thing, where they sold all the issues of Planetary.
That's interesting.
As
That's a really good
big
idea.
Lump. And it was cheaper than, I think it was under $1 each it worked out at. I think it was $25 for the whole thing, or $24 for the whole run.
It was very cheap. It was a very good deal.
But I don't understand why I can't go onto Marvel's app and buy a trade paperback. Why can't I buy all 6 issues at once, rather than hunting around, trying to find it, is this the same Inhumans series that Paul Jenkins wrote, or is this the Inhumans series that Carlos Pacheco wrote? Why can't I just buy all of a particular trade paperback? It's not like you couldn't just bundle these things together and set a price point on it as an entity, as a whole thing.
I think, to be fair, DC have said something about launching a new app, haven't they? So maybe they are going to overhaul the interface.
Well, they're launching an Android app, but I think that's just going to be an Android version of their current presence on Apple devices.
I think they really do need to overhaul that interface if they want digital to be a major part of their platform going forward. Because I find it virtually impossible to find anything on those Comixology apps. Mm-hmm. I just sort of skim to see if there's anything vaguely interesting that's new. And I suppose you can search for individual series, but it's, unless you know exactly what you're looking for, as a browsing thing, it's useless.
Yeah, it's not great. Last thing that Marvel have announced is the Season 1 initiative, which is going to be a series of initially 4 original graphic novels, retelling, according to Tom Braver in his CBR column this week, the first 5 or so issues of the original runs of these particular characters.
Yeah, I mean, he also said, to be fair, that they're going to restructure them and build it into a single story, so it's not just going to be an episodic thing.
Yeah.
But it's going to be the opening part of these guys' careers and of retelling updated for the 2011.
Yeah, I think that's because, apart from anything else, some of these things are a little hokey for people nowadays to read.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with remaking a story from 1963 for an audience of kids in 2011.
Goodness knows cinema does it often enough.
Absolutely fine. I've got no problem with that. Especially if your position is that you want all of this stuff to be valid in continuity, you might as well have a version of the story in print that actually kind of fits with the way continuity would be nowadays, rather than having everything look as if it's 1963. If it's meant to have taken place in 2002, fine, let's do it. If they're the key stories, then have them available for kids today in a way that's of interest to them rather than to historians. I think that's the point.
It's a big push to the bookstores. They don't have, the creative teams that are on them are not what we would call comics' big names. You know, the sort of the biggest names on there are people like Roberta Guerra-Sacasa and Jamie McKelvey, and to an extent people like Cullen Bunn as well.
It's interesting. They're people who've done most of their work for other publishers who Marvel are now bringing in for this sort of work.
Guerra-Sacasa, I guess, has done a fair bit for Marvel. He's written a few ongoings for them.
He's the exception, but virtually everybody else has done very little work for Marvel and is best known for their work elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But to the people who are actually going to be walking in and buying these in the bookstores, they don't know Brian Bendis from A Hole in the Ground.
No, exactly.
Well, they probably would know him from A Hole in the Ground. The Hole in the Ground could probably string together more distinctive dialogue. But when you get into the bookstore, what you're going to see is, you know, season one of the X-Men or whatever. And this is people, you know, people go out and buy season one of whatever. People are now trained through DVD box sets to know, oh, I start with season one, I'll do that. I mean, it's not a season, it's not a TV show, it doesn't matter. What you're doing is you're appropriating a branding from another format that people understand. People know this is where you start. Because what you could do is you could say, well, okay, well, we've got all these great jumping on points. Here's this book, here's that book, here's the other book. But what people will want to know is, yeah, but what's the first one? Where do I start? Where's the beginning of this story? And it's very difficult to try to explain to people, I think, that when you've got these 40 or 50 year soap operas, the place where you start may not be the beginning of its publication. It may be a year ago, it may be 5 years ago. We have these relaunches, we have these reboots all the time. But that's because we can get our heads around that because we're used to this kind of nonsense. We're used to this constant renumbering, and it's ridiculous. But people who are just coming into, you know, fresh from seeing X-Men First Class in the cinema are not going to look at all these books and say, well, I know where I should be starting with these things. And similarly, the Ultimate range is not the right way to be doing this either, because the Ultimates over the past 10 years is so divorced from the what it was supposed to be like, which is the will make it accessible and recognisable for people. What people have got now as the accessible, recognisable versions of the characters are the movies, and particularly Marvel's movies that have been done.
Yeah.
Iron Man, as the recognisable version, is like Tony Stark in the movie, which is like Tony Stark in the regular Marvel universe. You know, the X-Men, people look at it now, there's an aspect of it that's like the Fox movies, but the Ultimate comics are not like the Fox movies now. The Ultimate Universe over the past 10 years has basically disappeared up its own backside. And it's now become completely impenetrable.
It's now become the universe where anything can happen, which is what happens to all dying universes shortly before they get cancelled. It is. It's the last throw of the dice for every failed imprint, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that the season one, the way of doing the season one thing, I think it's a good idea. I think that you don't need the big name creators, because the big name creators are only here in comic books known as being the big names, and you don't need to be launching with the Ultimate stuff, because the Ultimate people will say, oh yeah, but so which one is this? Is this the real Spider-Man, or is this one of these other Spider-Mans?
The Ultimate books, I think, are now pretty much unmarketable to the general public. They've become an interesting sideshow for direct market readers. An interesting point that was mentioned in passing in Tom Brevoort's interview with CBR, where he was promoting the season one books, was they asked him, well, in the past, you've said Marvel doesn't do OGNs because they don't make financial sense. You need to do it as a serial in order to spread the cost, essentially, which is understandable. You're bringing in the money as you go along. I get that. And they said to him, well, what's changed? And the answer he gave was basically, I can't give you a full answer to that, but there's a new revenue stream for these, which we'll be telling you more about in due course. Now, I have no idea what that could mean, but he was vaguely hinting at something to do with Disney.
I was going to say, do you think it rhymes with Misney S'more?
I was thinking that, Disney stores. But yeah. Maybe they're figuring that these are things they're going to be selling as Disney store products, advertised at Disney World and available next to your plush toys.
You might as well use what you've got available to you, and if you've got Disney behind you, then why on earth not? So that's the news, and we're going to move
on. Hold on.
Oh, wait a second. No, yeah, there's one other big thing. Sorry.
You missed that entirely. Yeah, Marvel have won a summary judgment in the Kirby copyright case. This is the Kirby estate attempting to claim back the rights to some of the characters that he created or claims to have created for Marvel during the 60s. I say claims to have created because one of the more contentious inclusions is Spider-Man, and it's fair to say that the view that Jack Kirby created Spider-Man is a minority view, even among Kirby's most assiduous fans. The full judgment's available online.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I've skimmed it, and the thrust is, how do I put this? The thrust seems to be that the judge says that this is work for hire, even on the version of events being put forward by the Kirby estate. It still comes down to work that was commissioned by Marvel, their instance and expense. And I think as the judgment is right to point out, while a lot of the online discussion has always centred around, well, how much of this was created by Kirby and how much was Stan Lee and the apportionment of responsibility between the two, that's really a red herring.
Yeah, it's irrelevant to whether or not it was created as work for hire.
And precisely.
If it is work for hire, the game's over.
Precisely. It doesn't matter if Jack Kirby was created the Silver Surfer without it being in the script. That just makes him a work-for-hire writer as well as a work-for-hire artist. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get him anywhere.
Yeah.
The question is whether it's work-for-hire. And it sounds as though the Kirby estate really didn't have a great deal of evidence to rebut Marvel's version of events. Mm-hmm. Marvel had, within the good position of being able to wheel out Stan Lee.
Yeah.
I think, to be fair, Steranko gave a deposition for the Kirby estate, but it was Roy Thomas, Larry Lieber, and John Romita, I think. Certainly one of the other major 60s creators basically gave evidence in support of Marvel about what the usual practices at Marvel were at the time. And the Kirby estate had a couple of other freelancers reminiscing about how things worked at the time. The relatives of Jack Kirby saying what they understood Jack Kirby to have done, and which, you know, doesn't carry a great deal of weight. These are children remembering what their father was doing in work discussions. Mm-hmm. You know. And they had what they were trying to argue were expert reports from Mark Evanier and John Morrow. Mm-hmm. And as the court rightly points out, in law, in court, the purpose of an expert report is where you have something that involves like scientific expertise, for example, and you need somebody like an accident investigator to say, here's how long a car takes to brake, or a doctor to say, here's why this was negligent treatment, or here's how long that injury is going to take to heal. And really all that Mark Evanier and John Morrow can do is say, here's a load of hearsay that I've assembled over the years, and here's the conclusion that I've drawn from that. They're very valuable comics historians, but at the end of the day, that's the equivalent of calling to the stand a private investigator who says, well, I've investigated this and here's what I think happened. Mm-hmm. That's not an expert witness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as the judge points out in the judgment, it's not about is this fair, it's about is it work for hire. It's the only question that needs to be answered.
Absolutely. And it's worth remembering that even if Marvel and DC had been completely fair to Kirby and other freelancers, even if they'd paid them way over the odds, these claims would still stack up if they were good claims.
Yeah.
It's never been about whether the creators were treated fairly. It's just about whether the creators happen to be able to bring themselves within the four corners of this rather odd piece of legislation that's come in as a result of copyright extension in America.
So, yeah, that is the news this time. So we're going to move on and review a few comics. Well, we start with Amazing Spider-Man.
Let's start with this. Amazing Spider-Man number 666.
The comic of the devil.
This is billed as a prelude to Spider Island, which is the summer mini event, I guess, for Amazing Spider-Man. I was going to call it
a mini event. It's 28 issues, counting all the tie-ins.
I'm thinking
I counted up everything on that checklist. It's 28.
It crosses over into Venom and oddly Hook, which is set in Brooklyn.
Yeah, which is fair enough. Then, if you're going to have something which is set in New York, then it might as well cross over.
Brooklyn isn't in Manhattan.
It's not in Manhattan, but it's New York.
But it's Spider. I mean, all the Marvel titles are set in New York,
which is why you're getting the Avengers as well.
Yeah, but of all the titles to actually cross over, they've chosen one that's not in Manhattan. That it must need the sales.
Yeah, I presume so.
And there's a bunch of tie-in minis as well, such as a Cloak and Dagger thing and so forth. So you probably know by now the basic idea here is that the Jackal has released, for reasons which remain a little unclear, some sort of virus which is going to give everyone the powers of Spider-Man. Yeah. Now, in fact, the way it comes across in this issue is that they're not actually going to give everyone the powers of Spider-Man. It's going to be a small minority of New Yorkers, but, you know, 0.01% of the population of Manhattan is still quite a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's a story I'm much more interested in reading than the one they seem to be hyping, where everybody, including Aunt May, gets
Spider-Man. The tagline was, you know, if everyone has spider powers, then no one is Spider-Man, which is complete nonsense. As someone pointed out in our blog, it's like saying, if everyone has a gun, then no one is the Punisher. You know, it's completely ludicrous. But, you know, keeping it to a smaller number of people will work, I think, a little better as a storyline. This is written by Dan Slott and drawn by Stefano Caselli. And what we're getting here is what they're calling the prelude issue, but it's essentially part one.
That's clearly part one. I don't know why they're calling it a prelude, except so that they can hype part two as being part one, which is a common device these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's happened with things like the Iron Age miniseries, where Iron Age 1 is basically Iron Age 2.
Yeah. I've really been enjoying Dan Slott's work on Spider-Man. I think this is exactly the tone that a Spider-Man comic ought to be hitting.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to incorporate some of this. He's trying to incorporate the idea that Spider-Man's also in the Fantastic Four and the Avengers, which is requiring him to write the character as a workaholic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this would probably be a stronger book in some ways if it just ignored that stuff. But, you know, if it's there, I suppose in some ways it's a nice thing he's trying to embrace it and work with it.
I think that's building to something. I don't see him being, I mean, given that they're double shipping Fantastic Four issues 10 or FF issues 10 and 11 in October, so they can hit what would be issue 12 of FF and will, I'm quite sure in actuality, be issue 1 of Fantastic Four, or issue 600 rather, of Fantastic Four come November, which is the anniversary.
Right.
Although it's not really the anniversary, it's cover dated anniversary.
Well, he's obviously
actually shipped 3 months before then in 1961, but yeah, we actually, you know, August is really the 50th anniversary of Fantastic Four issue 1.
Yeah, but he's obviously going to be out of the Fantastic Four by the time of the inevitable relaunch.
Mm.
He may be being moved out of at least one of the Avengers teams, because he does actually show up in a recent issue of New Avengers and say he refuses to work with Victoria Hand anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That could all sort itself out by the end of the story, but at least that would get him down to being on one team as well as being Spider-Man, and that's a little more workable.
Yeah, so I think that's probably building to something, and Spider-Island is probably going to be a key part of that. What we do get to see in this, though, is the way that it impacts mostly on the people of Manhattan. There's a lot of stuff in here which is about not just what Spider-Man is doing, but what, you know, cops on the street are doing, and what his co-workers at this Horizon Labs are doing, and so on.
Other lesser superheroes.
Yeah, and yeah, because you get him fighting Hydro Man alongside the Young Allies.
Which takes him two panels.
Yeah.
Poor Hydro Man. Remember when he could fill two issues all on his own?
Poor the Young Allies. Remember when they could sustain a series?
No.
So we also get appearances from some of the other characters who are going to be involved. So you get Betty Brant and you get Venom. So I presume that's going to roll over into what's happening in Venom's own series.
Yeah, part of this is clearly about saying here's Spider-Man at the centre of a web of all these other characters who are connected to him in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And especially because he's now in the Fantastic Four and the Avengers, he's sort of a linchpin who's connected to everyone. But the focus is still more on his own supporting cast rather than his ties to the wider Marvel Universe. That's been one of the best things about this series since the relaunch after Straczynski's run, that they've re-established the book having a supporting cast,
yes.
which is something that had been completely lost sight of since really the early 90s.
Yeah, because you've got Nora and Carly and MJ all play a big role in his life. Betty plays a big role in his life as well. Flash has been brought back into the book now that he's being Venom again. And to
in a minor role, but he's there.
He is there. It does seem to be more the girls of his life than any of his male friends. You know, we haven't had Randy Robertson or anybody like that playing a really big role, although he has turned up.
But if you want to get back to the classic Spider-Man setup, that classic setup wasn't just about the status quo of Peter Parker himself. It was about a style of storytelling which was basically a soap opera encompassing all of his supporting cast.
Mm.
Now, I kind of get why they moved away from that, because they'd done so many stories with almost every member of his supporting cast being hauled into his life as a superhero that... Yeah, it had reached a point beyond parody.
Do you remember that bit in The Other where they go to Latveria and Aunt May and Mary Jane wear old Iron Man suits of armour and Storm Doom's castle? Yeah, this was awful.
I must have read that story, but I think I may have blanked it out of my memory.
It's so stupid and so bad. Like, it's properly the... I would say even worse than Sins Past. It's the nadir of Straczynski's run.
Now, I'm talking up the general... direction of the series here. I liked this issue more than I expected to, given that the way Spider-Island had been hyped didn't much appeal to me. I still don't think it's one of the better Dan Slott issues, partly because I don't really care about the Jackal as a villain. There's a lot of dodgy Spider-Man concepts in the late 90s wandering around here that, again, I don't really have much enthusiasm for.
And there's the Jackal, right? Because he was part of the original, like, Ben Reilly and everything. It's this issue 666. If you play it backwards, you can hear Mephisto reciting the Clone Saga.
I mean, there's a very vague villainous scheme in here, which involves characters I don't much care about standing around doing things that are a bit opaque. Mm-hmm. And that side of it, I'm not really interested in. But the idea that there's a bunch of other people wandering around Manhattan who got random Spider-Man powers now and are doing much the same thing but staying in the shadows, that kind of appeals to me.
Yeah, what it shows you is how would different people react to getting these kinds of powers. You know, there's some random hoodlum guy who decides that what he's going to do is he's going to use it as a new angle to work to get some money to pay off some loan sharks that he owes. That kind of thing. You know, not everybody's going to go out and stop bank robberies. Some people are going to... You know, there are two thugs earlier on in the issue who come back later on to follow Spider-Man around and are getting ready to take their shot at him.
And I get what Dan Slott's going for here. It's an inversion of the classic Superman loses his powers, but he's still Superman even without his powers. Mm-hmm. Everyone has powers, but Spider-Man's still Spider-Man because he's different. I mean, you mock the if everyone's Spider-Man, no one's Spider-Man angle, but you know, obviously the story is about why that's not true. Mm. To be fair, I mean,
yeah, if everyone is Spider-Man, one person is still Spider-Man. It does not make for quite such a snappy line.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm sure they know perfectly well why that's not true.
Mm. This book has got a lot of the setup stuff for. I suppose I can see why it's called the Prelude issue, because what it does is it puts people in the places for the rest of the story. It puts Kane in his place as this new tarantula character. Puts Madam Web on the board, puts Shang-Chi on the board. It sets up what's happening with J. Jonah Jameson and Aunt May's move to Boston, which was briefly addressed in a backup strip in the previous issue. And then at the end of the issue, it's all hell is broken loose. There are people swinging all over the place. And to be honest, a lovely page.
That is a lovely...
Caselli. Some of Caselli's work in this issue is a little shaky. There's some drastically awful foreshortening in a couple of the panels.
Mm.
But, you know, Caselli's always worked best when his work is a little more grotesque, I suppose. But where we are is we're ready to see where the story is going to go to. As a take-your-place-a-stage-a-set kind of issue, I think it works really well.
Yeah, it's a good superhero comic, and it's nice to see one of Marvel's flagship titles focusing on being, yeah, happy. It's a point we'll be coming to in a minute, actually, with Daredevil.
Yes, well, would you want to move on to Daredevil?
Shall we go straight into Daredevil?
Well.
Okay. Last week's, Daredevil number one.
Written by
Mark Waid. Penciled on the lead strip by Paolo Rivera, although there's also
backup by Marcos Martin. Yeah.
Yeah. This is the relaunch of Daredevil, who's been out of circulation for a whole few weeks since his miniseries
ended. It's been at least a month or two since Daredevil Reborn.
But in reality, this is the start of Mark Waid's run on Daredevil. It's not a new series, but it is, to be fair, a significant change of direction and style for the book. This is a very different feel from anything we've had on Daredevil in the last few years, which is largely because it's the first... Well, it's not the first take in ages, because Carl Kasell tried it as well.
But that was 15 years ago.
Yeah.
That was ages ago.
I think that Bob Gale did some stories that tried
Bob Gale did one story which has never been collected, reprinted, because it was so bad. I don't think it was because it was so bad, but it is pretty bad.
It was throwaway. It wasn't that bad. But this is an attempt to do a Daredevil story that doesn't exist in the shadow of Frank Miller, basically. The Frank Miller run on Daredevil is great, it's seminal, and in fairness, I think most people would accept that up until that point, Daredevil had been a bit of a D-list Marvel character. It's sort of it's a concept that's not entirely thought through. We've got this character, he's blind, except to all intents and purposes, he's not. That's not a great starting point.
There was a great story once in Marvel Comics Presents which had Daredevil and the Black Widow breaking into, I think it was a Hydra or an AIM installation to try to defuse a bomb. And so you had, from Daredevil's point of view in some of the panels, and Black Widow's talking him through defusing the bomb. She's like, right, there should be one cable that's two cables twined together on the left, cut that. And he's like, right, cuts it. And she's like, and then there are two thick insulated cables, pull both of those out at the same time. He's like, right, done it. And she's like, right, last thing, really easy, just cut the red wire. And he's looking at it, he's like, right, which one's the red wire? because he doesn't see colours. It's a really smart little bit of business with his powers.
But the fact that they made him, for example, able to read text by feeling the impressions on the page, at that point you've created a character who's effectively no different from anyone else, except that he can't see through glass, he can't see in colour, and
he's got a slightly more compelling secret identity, or more convincing secret identity, I guess.
Daredevil's been a largely miserable and depressed character since the Frank Miller era, when the emphasis has been overwhelmingly on his life falling apart, on everything collapsing around him, and on his slow descent into mental illness, culminating in, first of all, Brian Bendis coming up with the idea of outing him as Daredevil, which is actually quite a good idea. I like the idea of him being a character whose identity is an open secret. It's worked for the Kingpin for decades. Therefore, there's no logical reason why it shouldn't work for a hero as well. I see the logic in that, and I think it actually does give Daredevil a hook that he maybe didn't have before. But at the same time as doing that, you also mire the character even further in the misery of the post-Frank Miller interpretation. And then the next few years see that being followed through to its logical conclusion, with him eventually going mad and that being building to a head in Shadowland.
Yes, the grim, dark Daredevil.
Yes. And what they've done with Shadowland is they've used that as a dramatic excuse, more or less, to draw a line under Daredevil being miserable and say, enough of that, and change tone, have Daredevil come back determined to be a happy, upbeat character in a happy, upbeat comic, still saddled with the Brian Bendis setup that everyone knows he's Daredevil.
Yeah.
But actually, I think that maybe works better in a comic with this sort of tone, because if you do it in a grim and gritty, vaguely realistic comic, there's a certain credibility gap in him being able to function at all. But in a book like this, there's a bit more leeway.
When you're playing it a bit more freewheeling, then you can do a little bit more with that kind of setup, where you don't have to take it so seriously. Although an interesting aspect of this is that Wade is playing Daredevil as somebody who's saying, well, the only way I can cope with everything that's happened to me is to just be completely upbeat all the time. I'm going to be really chipper, a much more happy outlook on the world. And everyone around him is still going, but you went mad and you set up a big ninja hotel in the middle of New York. We can't just ignore this.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. There's a
There's a certain manic element to what Daredevil is doing.
You're absolutely right, and that's one of the ways in which Wade gets away with this incredible gear change, which is to have other characters standing around and going, hold on, you can't do that, that doesn't work. And on some level, obviously, Matt's in denial. But nonetheless, he has changed the style of the character. He has changed the tone of the book. The undercurrent is that Matt is obviously, you know, not quite all there. But as long that doesn't alter the fact that it's still now a happier and more upbeat book.
Yeah.
And that the stories he's going to tell based on that are still going to be in that sort of style.
Yeah, and Wade has a really great handle on the character. And he's only one issue in. I think this is going to be a book where Wade really hits the ground running and manages to do exactly what he's trying to do. And the other element of it, beyond the writing, which is very successful, and the thing that really, really makes this book, is the artwork. The artwork by Paolo Rivera on the main story and by Marcos Martín on the backup story is astonishing.
So two of the best artists Marvel have got in their books and working on the same title.
And firing on all cylinders.
Absolutely.
It's almost a kind of... like, they're working in a very European style. Like, they're obviously both European creators. And they're working in almost a kind of a modern French bande dessinée style. It's the kind of thing you would not be surprised to be able to pick up in Fnac or somewhere like that. And the way that Rivera manages to get Daredevil moving through space and constantly looking like he is actually on the move, even though this is comics, you're looking at static images, is extremely impressive. Yes. Martina as well has got this, for instance, the particularly nice double page spread in the backup strip.
This is just lovely.
Where Foggy and Matt are walking across the street and there's all the different things that are highlighted that you can hear and smell and so on. Just staggeringly gorgeous.
I've been really impressed by some of the work Martin's done for Spider-Man, and this is absolutely on a par with it. When he gets on to doing entire issues rather than backup strips, this is going to be a gorgeous comic.
Yeah, this is the best issue one of Marvel's last couple of years, I think. It is almost flawless. I so strongly recommend this book.
Excellent.
And the last thing we're going to look at now is Our Love is Real, self-published by Sam Humphries and Stephen Sanders. Stephen Sanders, you may know or may remember from his work on comics like Sword, the sort of short-lived X-Men spin-off that he worked on with Kieran Gillen. Now, this is not, I think it's fair to say, anything like Sword, or indeed anything like a comic that Marvel would really publish.
No. Well, the Max imprint might.
It might.
But, I'm wondering how we're going to explain this without forfeiting our iTunes family-friendly tag.
I think we stay clear of the F-word. We'll be fine. Our Love is Real is about a society, a future version of Earth, where the AIDS virus has been wiped out. 5 years later, what we've got is people who will have sex with anything. There are what they say, they describe them as vegisexuals, who are, I think,
fond of plants.
Yeah, what's the way they say? They feed them illegal growth thylakoids and manipulate them with ultra spectrum heat lamps, and then doing the nasty with those plants.
Mm.
And they're looked down on by the cop who's the protagonist of this story. And he looks down on them because why can't they just have normal, wholesome sexual appetites like he does for his dog?
Yes, it's because it's a mammal. You know, it's a mammal and that's natural.
Yeah. So Jock, who's the name of this cop, meets a girl, well, meets somebody called Bryn, who is a mineral sexual, who merges with the aura of her crystals.
She's Sting.
And she gets off on that, and it's essentially a story about intolerance, and it's a story which is satirizing the whole kind of stupid argument about, oh well, if we let gay people get married, then people will be marrying their dogs and their kitchen tables and their newspapers next, which is patently ludicrous, but some people do seriously claim it. And this is basically what this comic is, lathering satire all over.
Yeah, it's a very odd comic, but on one level you could say it's a one joke idea, but mm-hmm. I think it's actually quite nicely developed into a into a proper short story. It's a bit 2000 AD, actually.
Yeah, it reminded me of Transmit as well. Transmetropolitan had a similar sort of outlook on a lot of these kinds of issues. But where it goes beyond what could just have been a five-page 2000 AD gag strip is where it starts looking at the attitudes of the characters in relation to each other. For instance, where Jock is getting changed in the police changing room, and two of the other cops who are also dog lovers start taking the mickey out of him for going near a girl, and they're like, he's got a girl, ooh, kind of thing. And that's really well played, and the comedy of it is great, and the body language is great. Sanders is a really good artist.
Yeah, I actually prefer his work on this to what he was doing on Sword.
Yeah, it's less of a clean line than he had on Sword. Sword was very well delineated stuff, yeah. and this is much less so, but it's very, very good.
I love that panel of the bar entirely full of guys with their dogs.
Yes. It's excellent. He's also done the grey tones on this comic, which are really fantastic as well. I say colours, but essentially they're colours because it's different colours of grey, are really well done. It's a comic which is a little bit difficult to get hold of. There were, I think they did 300 print copies, but you can get it on Comixology. And I think it's something that's definitely worth checking out. You'd be advised to read it if you've got tolerance for comics which are a little bit on the more extreme side. Although there's nothing graphic in it, but it's certainly, it is a comic about a guy who has sex with dogs meeting somebody who has sex with crystals.
I think we need to be clear, there are no scenes in this comic of people actually having sex with anything.
No. But certainly that's the subject matter of the comic.
Yes, absolutely.
It's not just, you know, it's not a standing around talking comic either. There's plenty of other scenes in here. There's a good reaction scene at the end, a good fight scene, which Sanders does a really good job with. But the point of the comic is definitely its message. And it's a message which I think has gotten across very well. It's gotten across very humorously. And it's concise. It's a 28-page comic, counting the covers. And, yeah, done extremely well, I think.
Yeah, this is well worth getting digitally. Absolutely. Yep, I think absolutely. Probably the only way you'll be able to get it. But, yeah, download it.
Yeah. So that is the comics for this week. And we're going to move on to the official handbook of the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. And for the first time, looking at a character from the Black Panther milieu.
Have we not done a Black Panther character before?
I really don't think we have. I'm fairly sure we haven't, anyway.
Okay.
This is a guy called Horatio Walters, also known as Venom. Now, this is not Venom Eddie Brock. This is not Venom Matt Gargan. This is not even Venom Flash Thompson. This is not even Venom with one M on the end of his name. This is Venom with two M's.
How do you pronounce that? Venom?
Venom. You have to just put a big M at the end of
Venom.
It.
Venom.
Yeah.
Venom.
Things that make you go Venom. He is a guy who, when he was very young, was a poet and a sensitive soul. And when he was 9 years old, he received such harsh criticism of his work. I mean, who tells a 9-year-old how bad their poems are? Some meanie.
Everyone knows that you lie to 9-year-olds and tell them that they're very good.
Yeah, well, he gave up poetry at the age of 9 before, in a presumably unrelated incident, getting acid thrown in his face by one of his school classmates.
Yeah, there's no explanation in this entry at all of why one of his classmates suddenly decides to throw acid in his face, and the classmate never appears again in the story.
Yeah. And so what he decides to do is, completely understandably, of course, is go off and become an expert in snake charming and snake venoms. And so when he eventually comes back, he's a bloke who can control snakes and has this Toxic Avenger-style acidized face.
But otherwise looks perfectly normal. Yes. Yeah, he's one of these characters who looks like he was designed as a He-Man figure.
He does a bit, doesn't he? For the Hordax evil snakey horde, or whatever it was.
Now, Venom was initially used as a sidekick for Killmonger.
Yeah.
He was one of the henchmen in a Killmonger storyline from the early 70s, mm-hmm. From Jungle Action, the Black Panther series at the time. And then he reforms and just becomes somebody who lives in Wakanda. And doesn't get used very much, it has to be said.
Yeah, apparently turns up still... again in Priest's, in Christopher Priest's Black Panther run, in this sort of time when Sal Valuto was drawing it, where he returns to poetry and publishes a book called Lest the Snake Be Not Heard.
Lest the Snake Be Not Heard.
Yep, and he was at that point framed for an espionage thing, and you know, he's basically, he is to the Black Panther as Gladiator is to Daredevil. But he's not really been seen much since then. He seems to only have appeared in about two or three stories, so I think there's plenty that we could do with a guy like this.
Mm-hmm.
His powers are that he is a phenomenally gifted snake charmer who manipulates snakes through a combination of chemical potions. He roofies snakes.
That's unusual.
Hypnosis. He hypnotizes snakes, and as we all know from the Jungle Book, it's usually the other way around. And a practiced personal rapport.
Blackmail?
He chats up snakes. He roofies and chats up snakes. He would have fitted in really well in Our Love Is Real, I think.
He almost always wears at least one large snake on his person.
That does sound like the way that other people would go, well, I always carry a pen, just in case.
Well, to be fair, if your only power is snake charming, you're best having a large snake with you.
Yeah, you don't want to be out and about and suddenly you like, oh, here's a perfect instance where I could be doing some snake Oh, I left my snakes in my jacket!
Would you just hang on here, Mr. Villain, while I nip home and get a python?
Just got to go back to the car. I've got a few snakes in the car. I'll just get... Wait there. Yep. Yeah. So we're looking at a guy who is a poet with a rapport with snakes. Now, I'm seeing performance poetry here. You've got a guy who can stand up on a stage and recite his poetry as snakes act it out, perhaps.
Ooh.
He's a fringe show. He's coming to the Edinburgh Festival this year, Venom and His Amazing Snakes.
That would be impressive, actually. He just reads out some poetry and a whole load of snakes form interesting shapes behind him.
Yeah, exactly. They spell out the words and things like that. You know, it's Venom doing his performance poetry downstairs at the Tron.
Whatever happened to Princess Python, the Marvel Universe's usual snake-charming villain?
I think she might be dead. I think she might have died in... Fractions Punisher War Journal. Certainly there were a couple of stories with her in it. But she basically became this kind of washed up former glamour queen who just sits around the house with her snakes. I believe she's also blinded. It's a sad end for Princess Python.
There could be a nice little couple here.
The two of them under snakes.
Ex-villains with snakes. Imagine the wedding.
It's great. It's actually the concept for a reality TV show, isn't it? It's following the courtship and the nuptials of Venom and Princess Python.
And their snakes.
And their snakes. And it's just all the talking heads. So you've got Venom with his horribly scarred face going, I love Princess Python since the first time I laid eyes on her. And Princess Python going, I'm sure I would love Venom if I were ever able to lay eyes on him, but I can't because I'm blind. And then later on they're interviewing the snakes, and the snakes are going,
they're made for each other. She can't see his acid-scarred face.
Yep, but you know that...
But they're bonded by their love of pythons.
But you know
it is a reality TV show waiting to happen.
But you know that the snakes would come between them in the end, though. He can't stop roofying and chatting up snakes and writing poetry for them. And she's like, you never write poetry for me. You always write poetry for your stupid snakes. And he's like, what about your stupid snake? You've always got it draped around you. That snake hussy.
Venom and Princess Python are trying to get together, but the snakes are jealous and keep conspiring to keep them apart.
Or Venom and Princess Python meet, don't get on, and it's the Parent Trap, but with
animals. The snakes bring them together. That would be great.
Amazing. Oh, and I can see the Pet Avengers getting involved in some way in this kind of shenanigans. Has anyone got Chrissy Leopoulos' phone number? Anyway, Venom there, plenty we can do with them. That's the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. It's also the end of the podcast, but we'll be back in a fortnight's time. Until then, you can catch us on our blog, which is housetoastonish.com.
You can follow us on Twitter. Al is housetoastonish and I'm ifdestroyed.
Yeah, our email address is housetoastonish@gmail.com. And if you go to Facebook and search for House to Astonish, you'll find our Facebook fan page. And we'll see you in 2 weeks' time.
See you then.
Bye.
Bye.